Hey, it's Kyle Meredith, host of the Kyle Meredith With podcast, presented by WFPK at WFPK.org and the Consequence Podcast Network. It's a series that puts the spotlight on iconic musicians and actors, inviting them to drop by and talk about their latest projects, whether it's albums, TV shows, films, or beyond.
I'm going to say something I don't want to say. Here it goes. Without Spinal Tap, there is no Tenacious D.
Whoa. Man.
We get great stories and the biggest scoops from people like Garbage's Shirley Manson, the 1975's Matty Healy, Jack Black and Kyle Gass of Tenacious D, Maya Hawke, Kiefer Sutherland, and everyone in between. New episodes arrive every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, so it's a great way to keep up with your favorite artists and discover some new ones. You can find Kyle Meredith With on the Consequence Podcast Network or wherever you get your podcasts.
Consequence Podcast Network. Welcome to In Defense of Ska. We aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of the music. Ska deserves the respect genres like punk, hip-hop, and hardcore find among their listeners. But, as we show today, we are open to discussing positive and negative aspects of ska culture with fellow ska fans. Our host is renowned music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska, Aaron Carnes.
The Adjusters formed in 1995 in Chicago. They blended soul music, traditional ska, rocksteady, reggae, and socialist-leaning political lyrics. They released three great records. Their second, Before the Revolution, from 1998, was produced by the great Victor Rice and released on Moon Records. It's an underrated album from Moon's extensive catalog. In a lot of ways, the Adjusters were out of step with the lighthearted pop-punk-oriented direction U.S. ska was heading in the late 90s, so they didn't gain the audience they deserved. Today, we bring on their lead singer, Daraka Larimore Hall, who works in politics now, which shouldn't be a surprise to anyone who's read the Adjusters' lyrics. He loves ska, but does think there are valid reasons that 90s U.S. ska's look down upon. It's a topic we debate with him today. And now joining me is my co-host, veteran ska musician Adam Davis of Link 80 and Omnigon.
So I think I've said this before to you, but I really like when our guests are, you know, I like that the guests that we have on the show are pretty smart and progressive, especially as we age, because I feel like there's a lot of punks that maybe we came up with or we respected at one point who've kind of turned into dumb boomers.
Yeah, I think like with in the case of Daraka, he's a pretty left-leaning, politically active socialist. And like in the 90s, he was talking about socialism and socialist politics, which was very unpopular at the time.
Yeah, you didn't really hear that at the time. So, I mean, it's been, you know, 20, 25 years. What makes you bring Daraka on now?
Well, I've been a fan of the Adjusters, and he's been somebody that I've been considering. But recently, there was an article on Far Out Magazine called Third Wave Ska Was an Insult to the Genre. Just definitely like clickbait, like ska sucks type of stuff.
Yeah.
Everyone is like, this sucks, whatever. But he was commenting on our Instagram saying like, no, they got a point. I look forward to reading this. And, you know, I was fascinated by his like sort of taking the opposite position. And even though he kind of, you know, agrees that maybe the article was like a bit of a sort of not coming from an honest place, he definitely kind of looks at 90s ska differently than I think we do. And I am okay with that as long as the person saying it has love in their heart for ska. When they are just a ska hater to be a ska hater, then I could care less what they have to say.
Yeah, I say, you know, highlighting arguments like this, it's all part of the process of legitimizing ska and saying it's worthy of real, legit discourse.
All right. So as ska defenders, you know, I definitely have dealt with a lot of people who talk trash about ska in a very, I want to say, thoughtless way, you know. And but, you know, when people out, you know, people that are in ska want to criticize elements of ska, I'm happy to have that conversation because I feel like those of us that are part of the scene have every right to criticize parts of it. So I wanted to start by talking about some of your criticisms about 90s ska.
Okay. So You're going to put my, like, all my contact info in here, right? So I can just field massive abuse from angry dudes.
Yeah, yeah. If you listen to the whole interview, everybody, we're going to talk about his, you know, his involvement in ska. So keep that in mind. If he says anything that upsets you, that he is part of the ska family. So he has the right to say what he has to say.
Don't swat me.
So, I mean, one place to start is that there was this article going around called Hear Me Out, Third Wave Ska Was an Insult to the Genre. And everyone was like, fuck this, including me. But you were like, hey, you know, I think they made some good points.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so let me back up and just start by saying I love ska. Like, there's just a treasure trove of music that I think is really creative and phenomenal in all of the waves of like revival, Jamaican revival music and, you know, ska revival scenes and so forth. It's a lot of it's wonderful. I also think, like, in any scene or era of art production, there's some stuff that's just not very good.
Sure.
And that, you know, it all kind of gets lumped together, or if you've only heard a couple of bands from a particular scene, then you can sort of dismiss it all if it's not any good, or sort of, yeah, over-valorize it. What I really appreciate about your book and about you guys doing this podcast and just, yeah, the social media presence, everything, is that there's a particular stereotypical 90s or third wave ska sound and style and approach, sort of attitude, that has become like a real punchline in pop culture. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's like a TV show where it's like a running gag. And then, you know, memes galore about, you know, Obama hiding his 90s ska background, things like that. Right. It's just like, it's just a go-to thing of like, how do we make this person seem dumb and, you know,
or like if you want to be like this person, this cool person used to be a nerd.
Exactly.
Go two ways to be like, oh, they were a ska fan or a ska band in the 90s.
Totally. And it's funny. It's like they were in a ska band in the 90s or they played Dungeons and Dragons. And like both of those things are true of me. So I appreciate the defense. Like I think it's great. I think a lot of those things are cheap shots.
Yeah.
At the same time, and this is what I was responding to in that article, like some of that stuff is just terrible. And, you know, there was a real cookie cutter aspect to what was going on in that scene in the 90s. I mean, when we would go on tour or just like listen to the new releases on the like stalwart labels, it just seemed like every other one was what we would joke, we'd call Scottity Ska Ska and the Ska Skas, you know, just just trope on trope, everything from the breaks in the music, the lyrics, and the presentation just became just an orgy of cliches. Mm-hmm. And that's like all it took. And like the band sounded really the same and interchangeable. And that was, you know, what I think the general population of our generations got to know as being ska. And that's what people are making fun of. And that was a lot of what I think the kind of music, that sort of just very generic stuff that that kind of broke through, that was being complained about in the article.
Yeah. I mean, it was like Real Big Fish, Aquabats. I think these are the bands that they were kind of highlighting in the article.
Exactly. And I'll die on the hill of Real Big Fish being terrible. Like I think they agreed with the article on that. I just think they're just terrible. The Aquabats, you know, I think they're great for what they are. I mean, I think they're a great band. They're fun. I've seen them several times, always enjoyed it. Great people, all of that. And I love the shtick. I mean, I love a band with a shtick. Let me put it this way. Like, what do the Aquabats or Real Big Fish or Mustard Plug have to do at all with Jamaican music, with Black music, with anything connected to the actual social roots of this genre? I just think nothing. Like, they're not connected. Everything that was embedded in this genre of music, even if it was being played by an all-white band in New England or a group of working class kids in Nottingham or, you know, kids in South Africa mixing it with Gumboot, like, no matter who picked it up and did something with it, it's carried some meaning, some sonic and musical similarities, a heritage, so to speak, until the 90s American scene, where I feel like there were bands and there's music that started to come out where that had been just completely erased, like totally cut out. Mm. And then for that to be referred to as ska and be actually in the popular imagination what ska is, yeah, that's a kind of cultural erasure. I mean, I think I said in my comment on that article, like, I am by no means a purist about cultural appropriation. I'm of mixed race myself. I think mixing musical genres is beautiful. I think people listening to other kinds of music and being inspired by it and even trying to replicate it in some way, I think all of that cut and mix, Dick Hebdige, mix it all up stuff is beautiful. And it's like a thing I like about the diaspora of Jamaican music. So it's not like a purist in that sense. Mm-hmm. And I think lots of artists have done great things of, like, yeah, cutting and mixing and dabbling and so forth, or relocalizing a music. But if the blackness of something is just completely erased to the point that a Jamaican term for a Jamaican genre of music is referred to as the soundtrack, or like what plays in a kid's, what is it, like an adolescent boy's head when he gets more chicken sticks? Yeah. I mean, yikes. You know, it's like, and so even beyond, like, it's obviously just my subjective opinion, like which bands suck and which bands don't. And people listening can take that with a grain of salt. That's my opinion. But the argument that I would make, though, is that there's some stuff that happened in the 90s scene, and I think has like continued, that is creating music that just has nothing to do with ska. And it's really unfortunate that the term has mutated, or it's been appropriated, however you want to put that, to that extent. So that's my rant. Feel free to like interrogate it or pick it apart.
No, that's fine. I mean, it's fine. I would say, like, I like Real Big Fish. I've come to appreciate what they were about more, but I don't think you're wrong in saying that the connection between Real Big Fish and Jamaican music is a distant one. And I think they would agree with you there. I think the argument would be more just like, ska, how ska's evolved from Jamaica to two-tone to what was happening, you know, ska punk, you know, music kind of melding with punk, and their connection is one of many steps removed from the source.
So then why use the term? I mean, like, think about it in another context. If somebody was playing music that you could trace a line of influence very distantly to jazz, and like there was a white group playing music that was like all electronic noise or something, and they're like, nah, we're a jazz band.
Yeah, it is one of those things with Scott's, like, on one hand I see that point, like, maybe we need a new term for it, but I also think at the same time it's just what we've all collectively decided that this thing that's kind of progressed forward is ska. And I don't know that the hill I want to die on is that we need to rename this thing. Like, I think of ska as a very broad term, and that we can dig into the subgenres of ska and, you know, have these kind of debates about what subgenre it is. But broadly, ska is sort of just not wasn't my choice. I had no hand in it. This is what we've been calling it. So that's not really my fight, is to change its name, but maybe just to keep the conversation going about the broad groupings of bands and influences that have gone on to contribute to this thing. And we can look, we can dissect it from subculture or subgenres. Like this one's very much influenced by pop punk with, you know, these ska elements. So that's my take. I don't know that my take's too much different than yours. It's just, I've accepted that it's,
I mean, you're probably right. I'm not launching a campaign. Like, I don't know how to get people. I'm simply, like, for my piece of it, gonna keep saying that.
Sure. Yeah.
There's 90s ska that sucks. And there's stuff that I just don't think it makes any sense to call ska. It's funny. I mean, there is a little bit of a generational thing of like, I guess I'm old enough to feel enough like this is all like new and contingent enough that it's like possible to change. Whereas I think, you know, if you're just even just a few years younger than me and you're discovering 90s ska as like already pretty old music, you know, it would seem like, oh, well, this is just what we have, like what we came, like what we inherited. Whereas like,
yeah.
You know, I can remember the arguments with Chuck Wren and just being like, Chuck, this isn't ska. Like, what the fuck? This is so bad. and being like, you're such a snob. Like, you know, these debates have been going on forever.
By the way, Chuck, I think probably falls more in the line of where you're at now these days. Like, sure. He makes comments supporting what you just said when you rant. Whereas I think in the 90s, he wasn't really in that point of view.
Yeah. I mean, that's cool. That's interesting. I mean, we all grow. We learn. That's interesting. I mean, I'd love to talk to, I haven't talked to Chuck in years, and he's one of the my favorite people that I met in that scene.
I want to defend Mustard Plug a little bit and say that they, especially as they've gone past the 90s, have definitely been political and have said things of importance in their music. I just want to throw that out there about Mustard Plug.
I mean, I want to be careful about the sort of the relationship between politics and music is a big point.
Yeah.
And I think there's plenty of bands that I would absolutely say are ska bands that either don't have any lyrics or, you know, their lyrics are about everyday life or other things. And I think they're especially in the punk ska subgenres, like a lot of those bands are very political. I think that music is like just too far away from ska to be called ska and still love it. I mean this is the other thing I want to make clear is like I like all kinds of music. I like punk a lot. I mean, punk is a huge part of my life and trajectory of engagement with music and culture in general. And so it's not an insult to me to be like, they're just a punk band. That's not me being dismissive. Yeah. It's just being like, let's just keep some things clear. And punk and Jamaican music obviously have been joined at the hip and influencing one another from the start of both.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty hard. They're hard to disentangle. And which is beautiful. It's just like great. But let me tell a story from my sort of youth that might also illustrate where I'm coming from. So my dad's from Jamaica and I grew up listening to reggae as like just music around the house and as long as I can remember. And I was born in 1975. So, you know, it was as a little kid that the reggae became an international phenomenon. And my dad was really big Wailers fan, but also Toots and the Maytals and Third World, Muta Baruka, just like a political roots, Peter Tosh, of course, political roots reggae was what I grew up listening to, that and like Elvis on my mom's side. And then when I got into music sort of on my own as an adolescent, and it started building an identity around my musical taste in the way that we all did in Gen X. You know, I was into punk. And then, so getting into particularly British punk from the 70s and 80s, like, it made me rediscover reggae. Like, I got back into reggae because, you know, through Punky Reggae Party and just, and The Clash, you know, I'd hear The Clash playing reggae and be like, oh shit, this is like the stuff I've always listened to. That's cool. And it was like a really nice worlds colliding sort of thing. And it was in that period, in sort of junior high and getting into punk, that I first heard the word ska and heard about the Specials and the two-tone movement. And it was explained to me by like a punk older guy mentor of mine at the time. He was like, yeah, ska is like reggae and punk mixed together. It's like reggae, but it's played fast and it's more punky. You'll like it. Here's a band. Here's the Specials. Check them out. And I was like, this is awesome. This is really good. I, you know, it's political. It scratches a kind of punk itch, but it's just reminds me of all the stuff I grew up listening to. And so I went to my dad and I was like, hey dad, you know about ska? And he was like, no, I've never heard of it. It's music. It's like reggae, but it's kind of punky. And, you know, it's like very political and about blacks and whites uniting. And it's really cool. He's like, oh, that sounds cool. And I put on some Specials for him and he's listening to it. He's like, oh, you mean ska? And I was like, oh, it was like one of those horrible, embarrassing second generation immigrant family moments where I'm just like, oh, what a nerd I am. And and like, what a white thing to do. Like, here, like I went to my dad to like white splain Jamaican music to him. And he's like, oh, you mean ska? He's like, yeah, that's from before reggae. So he's just like schooled me and, you know, sort of set me straight. But imagine if I'd played Mustard Plug for him or Real Big Fish or any number of bands from the 90s. If I'd been like, this is ska, he would have been like, oh, okay. That's some weird other new thing.
Sure.
It's like, I guess it's sort of like a polka extract. Like, is this from like a, you know, Eastern European polka music played by punk rockers or something? Like, it would not have registered as being connected to Jamaican music. And that's fucked up. Like, there's something bad about that, I think.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I was talking to a friend of mine who's Jamaican and plays reggae. And I was like, what do you think of Two Tone? What do you think of the Specials, Madness and all that? He's like, oh, I like it, but you know, that's rock. Mm. Like he didn't even think of that as ska. And I'm like, that's fair. I mean, it's fair that to his point of view, that's rock music.
You know, one of the best documentaries I've ever seen, strongly recommend if you guys haven't seen it, and anybody listening, there's a BBC documentary about Jamaican music in the diaspora in Britain.
Is that Reggae Britannia? Is that the one you're talking about?
Exactly.
Yeah, I've seen it. Yeah.
Oh my God. That I used to show it in my introduction to sociology classes as a way to introduce the concept of culture and raise the questions of who owns culture and so forth. Well, there's this great Don Letts. I mean, there's like a bunch of great. So like, obviously, they did an epic interview with him and cut it all through it. But there's a moment where he's talking about the major label or the Island Records remix and re-release of an early Bob Marley album that they, you know, added a bunch of rock elements to.
Yeah. Catch a Fire.
Exactly. and how, you know, a lot of people were like, this is awful. You know, can't believe they, you know, they took the black out of it, or they whiteified it, however they said it. And Don was like, yeah, but for us, this was great. Like, this is what we wanted. Like, we'd only seen Jamaica and Jamaican culture represented in Britain with like Ride Me Donkey and like, look, we're all country bumpkins and so forth. And then to hear this really rich, modern rock mix and sound, like, you know, mixed together with reggae was like a revelation, very influential. And that's always stuck with me, is like, awesome. And so I think if you've got a record or a style or whatever that some purists are going to hate, that's probably a good thing, right? You're probably mm-hmm. being innovative, in the way that I think that the Specials and, yeah, you know, all the two-tone bands were, you know, second, third generation West Indian immigrants and their neighbors recreating 50s, you know, early reggae and ska and rocksteady, you know, through the lens of what was going on in their lives and other music that was being played and charting and so forth. And so,
yeah,
that's very different than like Yabby U or like other things that were happening in Jamaican music, or even the British reggae scene per se. You know, Oswald and who was the other big one?
Steel Pulse.
Well, Steel Pulse, exactly. Musical Youth.
Mm-hmm.
Even UB40, the big fucking cheese balls that they are, like, that was also a very authentic,
yeah,
like reggae thing happening. So, but they were like the British Byron Lee and the Dragonairs or something. But the point being, I'm rambling. The point is that your friend can be both right and wrong in that sense. And mm-hmm. that's fine and healthy. There's like, I guess to me, the Specials to, you know, early Bob Marley or the Israelites or, not the Israelites, who did this, Desmond Dekker, or any yeah. of those groups, right? Like, it's like when Dylan went electric. there is always going to be people saying that's a sellout, that's too far, you're ruining it, and so forth, where I think, yeah, anybody reasonable and not super dogmatic would agree that Dylan sounded great on an electric guitar and did great music on, you know, with a full band and so forth. So, yeah, that's how I see that. Like, I never wanted to be the caricature of the trad ska guy who's just like, this sounds a little different than a record made in 1962, so fuck you. Like, that's not the point.
Yeah.
No, it's a fair point. I mean, I come at it from a little different angle. And I think, to me, I think when I think about ska and I think about people, the way they characterize it and make fun of it, I just think if, like, rather than discluding, I just think let's include, like, if mm-hmm. everyone, if people think of ska as Real Big Fish and Aquabats and they want to make fun of the people that listen to it, because that's what I think of ska is, rather than say that's not ska, say, well, ska is also, and then you start mm-hmm. adding to it and you start looking at it from a very broad angle.
That's very mature. That's good. No, I mean, that's good. No, that's good. I'm like, you know, let's get into faction wars and fight people. also, you know, I also don't want to yuck anyone's yum, and just like sure. really want to emphasize that there's two different things I'm saying. There's that I think some bands suck, and there's like I think some music isn't ska, but there's music that isn't ska that is really good.
All right, give us a band that is not ska that you really like.
Yeah.
That would be considered ska.
Well, I think Voodoo Glow Skulls.
Okay.
Would be an example. And like a bunch of that very early punk ska. I'd say Operation Ivy is on the borderline. I mean, there's something of like the feel of reggae music and ska that they managed to retain, even though they were really a straight ahead, you know, East Bay punk band. Mm-hmm. but so they're like borderline. But there's a band that I keep like coming back to, listening to their album every few months or something. There was a band called The Siren Six. Uh-huh. You ever heard of them?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
My old band played with them a lot.
Okay. What was your old band?
I was in a band called Link 80.
Okay. I remember seeing that. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. So I remember seeing them and like really enjoying their live show. And also we played with them once at the Metro in Chicago, and they did the thing that you knew, all of us just heard this. Every other band, you know, like there's always like the part of the audience where like all the bands are hanging out, watching each other. Right. And so we're all, it's just like every other band on the lineup is watching them, and they're the band's leader, who I think was like the trombone player.
Oh, it was the sax player. Yeah.
But he like gets on the mic and he's like, "Hey everyone, we just signed to a major label and we're about to blow up. So this might be the last time you see us in a venue this small. Oh, so you should really get out here." And we were just like, "Oh my God, you're toast. Like, you're either going to actually be the biggest band ever,
or you're done,
or you're just, we're never going to hear from you again." And yeah, it was more of the latter. So, but they had this, new wave Police, but yeah, harsher, more post-punk thing going on. And even that kind of like attitude, and they all they did like turtlenecks,
all black, very mod.
So they had this, exactly, but like futuro mod, like mod meets Sprockets.
Yeah.
Like something. But I loved it. I mean, I love that shit. I thought that was great. And I thought they had some really good songs. And it was like, why do you have a horn section? Why do you have these like breakdowns and like the sort of, yeah, all of these sonic cliches that they had to put on to be a ska band that they just didn't need.
Well, I'll counter that though. I saw them play as a five piece, like further down the road, right before they broke up, and they had omitted any of the ska parts. So they still had the one alto sax player who was also the guy who did most of the talking.
Yeah. Well, they couldn't. He was like, he would have sued them. I bet he owned everything. You see, he had that vibe of like, they can't kick him out because then they'd owe somebody money.
And so they'd omitted all the ska, and they were also weren't doing the all black anymore. They were all just kind of dressing like hipsters.
Okay.
And it was so bad.
Oh no.
And we talked about this with another artist, Rory from the Impossibles. And I think when you've included ska as an element of your sound, and then you take that out, you're removing the thing that made your band interesting. Because like, I feel like as an element, it's cool to like, cause like with the Siren Six, they were informed by like the DC sound, like, mod stuff and ska. And they kind of put that all in a blender and it became this thing. If you take out one of those elements, then it's just, it falls flat.
Well, that's, okay. I mean, then I stand corrected, and they're not on that list, I guess. but I would say, I mean, I guess I just don't think that's always true in terms of, like sometimes the mix doesn't work and it's good to take out one of the elements. Like one of the things that we learned early on, and I think was a good call, was like we never really tried to blend genres and blend elements too much in one song.
Yeah.
Like we were like, let's play a bunch of different genres of music that all have something in common, but not try to do like mod rock as ska or even like ska as soul. There were some groups doing that in a really great way. Don't like, that's a thing you obviously, you know, Toots did it from day one and it's beautiful, but like we usually would just like play a soul song or play a ska song or play a reggae song.
Yeah.
because it's risky, I guess. I mean, maybe looking back, we were chicken shit about it, but that's really, you've kind of crushed me. Like I've thought for years now that there was potentially a really good band there in the Siren Six if they dropped the ska, and it's not true. That was the bailing wire and bubble gum that was holding it together.
It really was. And then a couple of the members went on to just do kind of an indie rock band called Big City Rock after that. And that, wow, that shit was real bad.
Oh no.
And I hate to hate on them because I love the Siren Six, but you know, if you don't like something, you don't like something. And also going back to the Adjuster stuff, you know, I was spending some time with the record. And while I do think it's a strong move to stay within the genre for the whole song, like you guys were doing, the only problem that arises then is if, you know, because you guys are doing a whole bunch of different stuff, if one song really sticks with a listener, then the next song is a completely different style. And it doesn't vibe with the listener, then they're like, oh, well, I like that one song, but the next one's not really doing it for me.
I mean, you maybe just described, you know, why I'm not a rock star. Like, I'm not a billionaire. I don't know. Maybe.
Let's kind of explain the formation of the Adjuster's now that we're talking about the band.
Yeah.
Sure.
So you're from Santa Barbara, but the band formed in Chicago, right? Mm-hmm. You were going to college there, and was it... Clay Harper, the bassist, and you that formed this band?
It was Clay and I were like the first people talking about starting a band. And it's funny because our plan was to start a ska band with Irish folk influences.
Mm.
I'm just going to let that sink. Like, just let that sit there for a while. So like all the really hipster, cool, black militant stuff that I said in the beginning of this podcast. Now go back and listen to that after hearing we were going to start a band that mixed ska and Irish folk. I'd actually been in an Irish folk, like punk sort of Pogues-esque band in high school. And really, I love that kind of music. So that was the idea. Then it was like, we broke for summer and came back and realized that was a terrible idea. And when we started putting the band together, we actually just started by playing, yeah, I don't know, like really kind of two-tony ska. And then when Matt Parker, our organ player who had been in the Donkey Show, and you know, it was just a kind of legendary, incredibly skillful organist and musician and, you know, mod icon, you could say. Well, that's my daughter you hear, by the way. That's Ada. She's mumbling a little bit. But when he joined, he sort of taught us how to play real ska. And we liked that. And we liked, and then again, like going out and hearing other bands that just sounded more and more generic. We developed in the direction that we did of like wanting to play something that was more traditional in terms of the sound, that was obviously very lyrically political, and that was tied together by a kind of pop cultural, youth culture, subcultural like heritage of mod. And yeah, I mean, like a mod jukebox is sort of where we landed. But it was really an evolution.
So in Chicago in the mid 90s, were there other bands that you felt like you got that were doing something similar to you, or did it feel like the scene around you was doing something different, like more in this punk kind of weird, you know, influence direction?
So it's been a bunch of years, and I hope someone like Chuck is listening and can correct my memory told the rest of the Adjuster's, we've got like a little Facebook group about this interview. And so maybe they can correct me, but definitely the feeling was that there weren't other bands in Chicago doing the same thing we were doing,
mm-hmm.
both on the level of being political and the sound.
Yeah.
But there were other bands in the Midwest. Like one band we really liked playing with and really liked was Isaac Green and the Scholars, or then the Scholars. Mm-hmm. We toured with the Articles, both in the Midwest and in the South, which was incredible. Like I look back and I'm like, dude, you played a show in Atlanta and you talked about why it was great to burn down Atlanta in the Civil War. Like, you are so lucky you are alive. There were like literal Nazis there. And I was up on stage being like, we're going to burn this town down again. Yeah. You know, and yeah, it was wild. But they were great, just a phenomenal band, especially live. And even though like they were very much, they were a jazz band. They were playing like Jamaican jazz really hard, and in a really fun way live. We still felt a kinship that, you know, they were like trying to do good music that was proud of its roots in Black music in a way. And that was cool. But then otherwise, I think we really saw ourselves in terms of similar bands as having more comrades on the East Coast, and to a lesser extent on the West Coast, though the West Coast at the time felt like a total weird other country, in terms of the music scene. But, you know, so that's why we like toured and became, you know, friends with the Slackers, and really loved playing at the Wetlands, and like just as often as we could get to New York, we felt like we, you know, there was just like more similar stuff going on. The Midwest really felt like it was a ska punk territory.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of how it looks like to me, you know, looking back at the bands, particularly the bands that were more popular. I'm sure there was lesser popular bands that were doing different stuff, but the ones that,
yeah,
the ones that were drawing big crowds, it seems like it was very much ska punk.
Yeah. And remember, like we never minded like being on a bill with punk bands, particularly political punk bands. And we saw, at least I did, like that we also fit in a scene of bands with an affinity towards like mod music, or scooters and the scooter scene, or being sort of outright left wing and political. So we would do things with like, you know, left wing skinhead groups. We really liked that band, The Strike. It was like a jam. I mean, the band, The Jam style, like three piece, just four on the floor, like, you know, mod rock, mod punk. And we were like, yeah, they're like us. So, you know, it wasn't that you had to sound like Hepcat, you know, or something for us to be like, yeah, you're like us. There were different points of commonality.
We'll be right back after this.
I want to talk about the political element of the band, because I feel like that's a pretty important part of the Adjusters and to you specifically, because you were politically involved before the band, right? I mean, you grew up in a family that was political and stuff like that. And
yeah,
starting the band was having the band be political was an intention, like, from the beginning, right?
Totally.
And also specifically, like some of the stuff that you were representing and talking about was socialism, right?
Mm-hmm.
As part of the band's statement, if you will.
Yeah.
I just wanted to learn a little bit more about that. And I assume that it might have been a tough sell at the time. I mean, I think we're still struggling with this idea of like socialism being a bad word, but I think the needle has moved a little bit to where enough people are talking about it that I don't think, yeah. But in the 90s, I'm trying to think about anyone talking about socialism in the 90s being like, ooh, no. You probably sound like you're advocating for the Iron Curtain or something.
That's a great question. I mean, it's amazing. When I was at the Democratic National Convention in 2016. So this was, you know, Bernie versus Hillary civil war in the party. Very tough convention. People were mad. People were throwing things. People were throwing each other. It was terrible. But I just sat back out, you know, because all the Bernie folks, and I was a Bernie delegate, were just like crushed and sad and angry. And, you know, some of them were like literally in the hallways joining Jill Stein's campaign and all kinds of dumb shit. And I was like, man, if someone had told me in 1994, when I was, you know, getting active in DSA and the Democratic Socialists of America and, you know, out there talking about capitalism and so forth, somebody told me, hey, like in 2016, a socialist is going to win 45% of the vote at a Democratic National Convention, like that millions of people will support him, that thousands of delegates will be won and be at the convention. I would have told them that they were totally smoking some good shit and they needed to share, you know, it would have been like, what, like, wow. You know, the prospects in the '90s, deep in the Clinton era, right, was one in which the Democratic Party was just maniacally severing ties to the left. And yeah, Bill Clinton was out there talking about the era of big government being over and we're going to destroy welfare as we know it and all of this. And those were the good guys. The bad guys were, you know, Newt Gingrich and the Contract with America. And really, you know, looking back, one of the real milestones and stepping stones of the Republican Party turning so hard to the right, to the point that now, you know, it's controlled by a fascist. Like these things were, that was the reality. And so we really felt as socialists, we felt like we were the opposition within the opposition, within the opposition, so to speak, and quite marginalized. So it was like hard work being a socialist. And after college, actually went to work for DSA and worked for DSA for 2 years as a youth organizer when we had like 4 staff people total and 8,000 members, I think. And then after that, moved to Scandinavia for a couple of years and worked for labor and social democratic youth organizations there before I moved back to Santa Barbara to start graduate school in the early 2000s. I'm like a politics guy. It's my thing. I was, you know, raised up in a political family, and it's what I consider my vocation. And I, growing up, had always really loved political music. Most of the music that I listened to was political. As I've gotten older, I've gotten more into music for its own sake and listened to things much more aesthetically. But certainly from my teenage and into my early adult years, it was like if a band wasn't, or an artist wasn't saying something about the state of the world, it just seemed really empty to me.
You're a person that's involved with politics. Mm-hmm. So we call bands political bands if they have a message of some sort or comments, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're involved with politics per se. Right. It just means that they are saying something of substance. Did you think of it differently being a band, you know, wanting to be a band that's political, that it was actually tied to politics in some way or some sort of action within the political system?
Yeah. I mean, we were influenced by the British tradition of bands and scenes, you know, either starting organizations or being tied to political organizations, but being more than it being more than just lyrics or a pose. You know, so in the 80s in Britain, there was Rock Against Racism, a coalition of bands fighting the growth of the far right. There was the Red Wedge, which was led by folks like Billy Bragg and Jerry Dammers from the Specials, which was like really cool and innovative, I think, because it was a sort of it was pro-Labor Party and it was trying to get the vote out for the Labor Party, but it wasn't part of the Labor Party, and the leaders could also sometimes be critical of the leadership of the Labor Party, but it was like, yeah, getting out the vote. And so we, kind of started at a political organization to be like affiliated with us that we called the Modern Action Club. And then, you know, we did a lot of stuff for and with DSA because of my ties, and a bunch of the members of the band were members or activists in DSA. And I'd say, yeah, never a majority, but always a strong plurality. And then the politics of everyone in the band, except our original trombonist, who is conservative, you know, everyone's been left wing and, you know, thinks political activism is good, even if that's not their main gig. So it worked. And it was, and so, you know, there were other bands that, like, I consider the Slackers a political band. They speak out about political things. They write about it in their songs and so forth. But we wanted to take it, yeah, a step further and be like, if you like us, here are ways you can get involved. You know, putting ourselves at the, our own work and so forth to the benefit of different causes. Our first t-shirts that we made were like, we silk screened on the back of anti-sweatshop t-shirts. And we did several efforts and events and so forth in the 90s campus-based worker rights and anti-sweatshop movement. Our model was like, if you're out there being like, yeah, revolution, change the world, like, you've got to do more than just pose on a stage.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Was your goal to, did you have any specific goals that you were trying to get, you know, across to people? Was it to, sign up for and participate in these organizations? Was it to vote? Was there anything specific that you had in mind that you felt like was a way to measure the success or the impact that you were having as a political group?
No. I mean, that's like an excellent question. And it's something, measurable goals is not something I learned as an important part of doing politics until like my 30s. So that's a very astute question. I mean, because it's like, especially if you're a socialist, if you're someone who would like to see significant structural change in our society and economy, you know, it's not an easy question to answer. Then how do you measure your success? Is it socialism? Then we're always failing. Everything's terrible. And you just want to go home. Right. If that's right. So, but that idea of being like, okay, we want to get there, but we need to get there step by step. And here are the steps. I mean, I understood that theoretically. I mean, that was the great thing about coming up in DSA in the 90s, is that it was led by a bunch of veterans of left movements that had gone crazy and sectarian and imploded and didn't want to do that again. So I got a very good education in pragmatic radical politics. But I didn't really know how to do it myself as an activist until much later. And I think one of the awkward things, and this is just like par for the course with the kind of politics that DSA had, that I have, is that it's somewhat nuanced in that, like, I'd love to see capitalism smashed and replaced with a more humane, less coercive, more egalitarian economic system. But I think that the revolutionary attempts to get there sort of overnight and through violence have been horrific failures and led to some of the worst regimes in human history. And I think that, you know, the liberalism of someone like Joe Biden is hugely lacking and, you know, endangering us in terms of not making progress on climate and way behind in terms of repairing the gigantic gap between the rich and everybody else that's been happening over the last 30 years. Like, and then don't even get me started on his Gaza, you know, head in the sand nonsense. Mm-hmm. But all of that said, I still want everyone here listening to this to vote for Biden. And in fact, like, do some volunteering to help Biden get elected, because a Trump victory is a horrific nightmare. Like, he's going to come back so much worse. and yeah. we have to stop yeah. it. And the only thing that is actually going to stop it is electing Joe Biden. And, but like that yeah. doesn't play out well in like punk rock slogans.
Yeah.
And so like trying, like it's one of the things about political music is it often has, getting back to exactly your excellent question, right? How do you actually get there? Are there measurable goals? Like political music usually doesn't have those things, right? It's usually just like, tear it down, smash the system, fuck the man, kill Babylon, blah, blah, blah. Like, that's it. And then you have no more further responsibility. You've done it. You're political. You're on the right side. You go home. You know, you're finished. Let somebody else figure it out. And we were actually trying to articulate something more, yeah, achievable, winnable, staving off things getting worse, taking responsibility, those sorts of things, which, yeah, sometimes clashed with part of the fan base that liked our slogans and the revolutionary part of our attitude and rhetoric and so forth. So many times, both in Europe and in the US, I've had conversations with fans who are like, yeah, I really like your music. Like, it's really great, but I understand you're like a sellout who works for the bourgeois Democratic Party, and you're telling people to vote for Democrats, and that's not very revolutionary. And, you know, Lenin said blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, yeah, bro. Have fun, dude. Yeah. You know, like, we played with, do you know that band, The Insiders?
Oh yeah, I know them.
You know The Insiders?
Yeah.
So talk about a band, and they were originally from the Midwest, I think, Detroit? Or am I getting that wrong? Anyway, that's a band that was very much doing similar stuff to us. I mean, it was like ska, soul ska. Like,
yeah, they're based out of Santa Cruz these days, right? And it's pretty much leaning into the Northern soul sound, I think.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, they kind of dropped the ska part of it, right? And they're just like straight ahead playing soul, which is great. I love that music, and I'm glad there's people out there rocking it. They also always had a political bent. They were the Inciters, you know, and like and that's cool. But years ago now, I went and saw the Agrolites, another amazing band, playing here in Santa Barbara, and the Insiders were opening for them. And I was like outside hanging out, catching up with their keyboardist and just talking. And like somebody in the Insiders, I could hear him talking like obviously loud enough for me to hear, like just so clearly talking so I could hear, and being like, well, really there were two bands that came out of the scene that had socialist politics. There was us and the Adjusters, but the Adjusters, you know, they all went to University of Chicago, and they're middle class. And so their politics have always been reformist, and they're like reformist politics. And we're like working class band. So we're revolutionary, and you know, we want a real socialist revolution. I was just like, oh my God. And I just laid into him. Like, I don't remember all the things that I said because I just unloaded on him so hard. And it just, that kind of posing just fucking infuriated me. So the point being, long story short is, we were a political band, so we would get shit from people who were like, I don't like politics in my music. We were a left-wing band, so, you know, that meant that, you know, there was a certain mainstream appeal we would never have. But we were a reformist band, so the real revolutionaries out there were always suspicious of us. And that's
yeah.
That's why we never broke and never became. obviously not.
So, okay. The band forms in 95, and you play your first show on University of Chicago in a dank basement.
Yeah.
What do you remember about that first show?
Oh, I mean, I remember it really well. There's a really interesting guy who put on shows in his basement. He also did the thing that you used to be able to do. I don't know if you can get away with this anymore, but he would like go to music equipment shops and buy recording equipment, take it home and keep it for 30 days, use it and then return it. And so he had, he had a four track. And the first time we ever recorded anything, this was obviously terrible, trying to record like a 7-piece or 8-piece, whatever we were at the time, on a four track in a basement. But anyway, he was like one of these scene hubs, stalwarts. And so he put on, it was us and actually the other, this is funny. The other band we played with was like, their heroes were the Jesus Lizard. And they were just this like incredibly tight, but noisy, just screamo band. And their bass player actually ended up years later filling in one of the many times we were without a bass player, and like played on some records and albums and or tours and so forth. And then many, 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 many years later, he and Jess Basta, our other vocalist, got married, and they're happily married and live in Los Angeles. Sorry, I just put that together, that like our first show in that basement ended up producing kids. There's like human beings walking around on the earth because we played that show, which is just funny to think about. But it was also memorable because there was flooding in the basement. Like Dank was not, that was not a joke. The basement flooded. And so people had to go and run and get a bunch of kitty litter to spread out to soak up the water. But we're all there like with, you know, plugged in guitars and amps.
Ooh, good idea. Yeah, smart.
Oh, it was, it could have been a thing that you like read about in history books as like, you know, the horrible block fire of 96 in Chicago that killed all these kids. But yeah, that was our first show, and we played a lot of shows on campus, or, you know, in parties and people's houses around Hyde Park.
And then, so the first non-campus show you played was for the American Scothic Volume 4 release.
Hey, if you're reading it, that's probably true. That sounds right. I mean, definitely the shows that we played around in the city were almost always related to Chuck's operation in some way.
Yeah. When and how did you get connected to Chuck? Because I know he released your first record.
Yeah. Well, it was, we were on one of those comps. Like, we sent a demo and he was like, awesome, and put it on a comp. And then we started talking at shows and he liked us. And he pitched us to do a split with another band, like a split CD with another band, like a 4 songs each sort of thing. And then, so we went into the studio and started recording those 4 songs. And we were like, this is going great. I think we have something really here. We could do a whole album. And he agreed. And so that's where Politics of Style came from. And that was like basically our first set. Put down on a record, and we had no idea what we were doing, which is why it sounds so, I don't know, muted, something, all mids. Something Jessica always said. Vic Rice like kind of agreed to produce the rest of our stuff, that there was just something about our sound. It's like always all mids. Like, we never had really good bass or even like high harmonies or trebles or something that came out, like popped out. There was just something strange about us.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
Yeah, so the second record, Before the Revolution, was on Moon. And like you said, Victor Rice produced it.
Mm-hmm.
Had you guys been touring heavily up to that point? I'm curious, like, how you ended up on Moon at that point, and what things were like for you. Because we're looking at, like, I think 98 at that point. So ska's a mainstream genre at this point. I'm sure you feel out of step with that, too, as well, at the time.
Well, a couple things that happened in terms of like labels in the scene. was because there was also Hellcat. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Hellcat and what Hellcat was doing of like taking, they just signed a handful of bands, small group of bands, and they were going to just really invest in them and really push them out there and have them ride the coattails of the Warped Tour and ska becoming mainstream and just that whole moment. And we tried to be one of those bands through contacts that we had, and they didn't bite. But we wanted to go to a label that, had more reach. And to be honest, I don't know how the offer first came, but I know that it was Steven at Moon who really was our champion and really mm-hmm. pushed us. There was also a scandal. Somebody at Moon ran off with a bunch of money, right? Around that mm-hmm. time.
Yeah. I don't know who it was, but there was some embezzlement issue at Moon.
Yeah. Now it's just all coming back to me now. So, I guess what I was saying is Hellcat was going to do the punk, ride the Rancid Green Day wave. And then, Bucket and Moon was going to we're going to take everything else. The two tone sounding bands, what was sort of becoming a 90s sound kind of ska punk stuff. And then traditional bands, whoever, and we're going to be like the label that if a kid gets into ska because they see one band they like on MTV, they're going to find our catalog. I mean, I think that was the strategy. So they expanded a lot then at the end of the 90s. And we did that record. It was, from their perspective, a kind of expensive record because we had Vic Rice producing. We took quite a while in the studio, a couple of weeks. And took our time mixing it and everything. And I think it shows, it's a nice sounding record, and Vic did an amazing job.
We had Victor Rice on the podcast a while back, and he mentioned your record as one of his favorites from that period of time that he was producing for Moon. I just want to throw that out there.
Yeah.
That's really cute. That's cool. I appreciate that's really cool. I mean, I think he had a blast, because I think from a producer standpoint, it's a lot of fun because there were so many different genres, and it was now we're trying to do Northern Soul. Let's get that sound. Now we're doing this. I mean, to give you an idea of the budget, I mean, it was not a major label budget, but it was more than a label like Moon probably should have been spending on records. The other, we also had, what's his name from the Mekons and.
Yeah. I noticed that you had John Langford from the Mekons, which is
John Langford. Yeah.
That's a strange connection. Yeah.
Well, so he lived in Chicago and had, I don't know if they're still around, but he was doing this punky country and Western political band. And that's how I sort of got reintroduced to him. And so, we're like, hey, let's bring him in to produce a couple of songs. And he ended up doing the, sort of masked vocal tracks on an instrumental. But he cost a bunch of money and maybe it wasn't worth it for two tracks or whatever, but we thought it was cool and it was cool. So I think that record ended up being a real sort of quintessential statement, if you could say, of our sound. It's the median, the mean of what the Adjusters were about is on that record. So one funny thing about that album, an anecdote is that, and that also places it in time, is that, we liked to have cool names for our instrumentals, and we took a lot of influence from the Scatolites and other bands that would name instrumentals after people in the news and so forth. And so the song Special Prosecutor. I threw out there that we should call that song Monica Lewinsky, because there'd been the Scatolites song, Christine Keeler. It seemed perfect. Right. And I remember there's this argument ensued, and the majority believed, thought that nobody would know who she was after a couple of weeks. Like nobody would recognize the name Monica Lewinsky. So I think it was Matt was like, well, we can still like reference the scandal by calling it Special Prosecutor, you know, which is what Kenneth Starr was and that like outed the affair and so forth. So the we didn't think Monica Lewinsky would be a household name after our record came out. And that was wrong.
Yeah. So I'm curious about the title of the record, especially in light of everything we've discussed about your guys' politics and your guys' attitudes towards being a political band. What did it mean before the revolution?
Yeah, so that was actually a multi-level meaning, at least for me. It's the title of a film by Bernardo Bertolucci, an early film of his, and you know he was a Marxist filmmaker, and I was very influenced by and interested in the Italian left, and had friends in it, and of course like aesthetically Italian cinema and fashion. And the scooters and everything. It's just like a huge part of the whole mod aesthetic world. So it seemed like a cool reference. And then, you know, I just had this feeling, I mean, we all do, right? Of like that we live before things are going to get better. Like that we're in Babylon. We're in,
yeah,
the time before we get to the promised land. And so especially in the 90s, you know, we're like heading towards 2000 where, you know, we have this weird post-ideological president. It was an awkward and strange time, but I even then felt like something was coming. And then, you know, so like in the liner notes and in thinking about it and sort of explaining it, and I think in maybe even some of the lyrics to one of the songs, like just trying to reference also that this feeling of being before the revolution might be a really long time that, and that was, you know, not for nothing, that idea that, that change, even positive social change, is slow and systematic rather than quick and explosive and revolutionary, you know, is an idea that was developed really well by Antonio Gramsci, an Italian Marxist who was murdered by Mussolini or Mussolini's government. And so it was just like all a mix together of that. And then I was drinking buddies at the time, with Tom Frank, who's a left-wing writer. Folks out there might be familiar with his book, What's the Matter with Kansas? Or his last book was Listen, Liberal. Just a really great social commentator. And I was like, hey, bro, can you write the liner notes for us? And so, you know, he riffed on a lot of those same themes. So it's a very precious little package, that record, of a lot of like references and inside jokes and symbolic references to different things in left-wing politics, the aesthetic traditions that we were interested in, or I was interested in, or came with the mod baggage, so to speak.
Yeah, I don't have I couldn't find any images of the liner notes online, and I don't own the physical CD of the record, but I have an MP3 of it.
I'm not saying that like, how do you not own a record? I'm saying that because I have a giant box of them in my closet. And so like, I'm happy to send you a box. Would you like 550 of them? Yeah. No, I mean, whatever. It's just funny to me to think about them. They're like coasters around.
I did read online people commenting on the liner notes saying stuff like, if you weren't aware of the fact that they were a political band by listening to the music, you definitely will if you read the liner notes. They are pretty upfront about it in the liner notes.
Well, yeah. I mean, I come out of punk rock, and like was really into, I mean, I still like them, the band Crass, who would like put out a booklet with every album, you know, just like deep anarchist, feminist, revolutionary theory. You know, we weren't quite that didactic, but that was the idea. You should get an education.
One of my favorite songs on the record is Armstrong. Both musically and it's interesting lyrically. I'm curious if you can kind of speak on that song a little bit.
Well, it's definitely like one of the tracks where we really got a pop ska sound down, and probably like is an example of what you were talking about before, that if someone just heard that song, they might be disappointed with the rest of the album. You know, they're like, oh, this is cool, I like this. And then they're like, what's the rest of this weird shit? But the lyric, I mean, the idea, I just like songs that are stories about larger than life characters. And that, so yeah, I was just thinking about, I just made up a story about a guy who works on the docks and, you know, sort of a Harry Bridges character that, you know, things, labor issues on in that part of, the, of capitalism as I've always been, you know, kind of violent and tough. And I think part of what I was inspired by, well, definitely the film Last Exit to Brooklyn, which is one of my favorites. And then there was this bar in New York, it's probably still there, that somehow we ended up drinking at a couple times when we were out there, that is like literally underneath, I think, the Manhattan Bridge. And it was a dock worker bar, but also a gay bar. And so when you went in there, there's all these like stickers and things on the wall. There's like dock workers union and, or longshoremen, right? The longshoremen's union. And like pictures of like, even like union officials and so forth. And then a ton of rainbow stuff and like safe space and like silence equals death and everything. And the few times I went there, there was hardly anyone in there. So I never got a sense of whether it was like on certain nights it was one crowd and on certain nights it was the other, or they mixed, or it was like the spot if you were a gay or queer longshore person, that's where you went to. Like, could be. It's New York. It's big enough that could be a constituency. Anyway, I just like, I just had this kind of romantic view of a kind of postmodern labor leader coming out of the waterfront.
I see.
Yeah, and it just seemed like a fun story to tell.
Okay, so were you part of the band for the third record?
Yeah. That's interesting that you asked that. Have you heard the third record or?
I have not listened to it yet, and I know, but I am aware that there was a bit of a turnover leading into that record, right?
Yeah. Well, the reason I asked, it was like, I wondered if you could listen to it, because I'm not on it as much as other records that have, and it's such a big stylistic turn that it would be interesting if somebody was like, yeah, are you even on that thing? Okay. So the third and final record.
Otis Redding Will Save America.
Yeah. That was a interesting record. So we were talking about Moon. So, before the revolution and we did some touring, we were like, had ideas to do a third record. And that was kind of a thing about the scene, right? Is like people were popping out albums like every year or two, because that's how you made the money, how you made any money, right? Is like, totally different world today, obviously. Like, you toured to sell your CDs back in the 90s. So having a new product out a lot was a big important thing to kind of get to some sustainability. Not that we ever were anywhere close to that. But the third record starts with me almost breaking up the band. This is like a moment of my early adulthood I'm like the least proud of. That I was a summer in Norway in like 98. I was in Norway and I got really fucked up. And I sent this really long email to everyone in the band with this like dogmatic declaration that we needed to stop just playing old genre music and we needed to integrate some new, more current sounds. Because I had been totally blown away by some tracks that were coming out of the British big beat scene, you know, it was a Fatboy Slim being okay. like the sort of biggest figure in that. But there were like all those guys that were making those, that music were super into ska and reggae and soul and so forth. So like the samples and the, even some of the song structures and so forth that they were drawing on, a lot of it was just exactly the kind of music we liked. So I heard, especially, what was it called? Rockefeller Skank, which was a kind of remix of a track called My Mate Paul, like early big beat dance track. That's just like all these great ska samples. And it sounded so good to me and so interesting and fresh, like taking just a traditional rock steady or ska song and cutting it up and redeploying it, you know, in terms of with break beats and so forth. I loved it. I was so excited. And so I was like, we have to take this turn. And as a result, our drummer quit and a bunch of people were like on the fence. And so when I came back from Norway, I had to like mend fences and eat crow and be like, look, we don't have to go in this direction or whatever. I'm sorry. I was being an asshole. I don't think I was quite that contrite, but looking back, I should have been. But some of the people in the band were like, hey, this is kind of cool and this is interesting. So we first gave some of our, the raw recordings to my friend Oscar, who I know from here in Santa Barbara, and we'd been in bands together in high school, who is an amazing, just multi-instrumentalist songwriter. His current project, by the way, which I have to put a plug out for, is called Gangsta Grass. It's a mix of old timey country and hip hop. And they actually did, you know, that TV show, what's it called, with Timothy Oliphant? He's like a Kentucky lawman.
Justified.
Justified. Thank you. So the theme song to that is his band. Gangsta Grass, and it was actually nominated for an Emmy for it. So if you like that sound, like the mixing of scratching and beats and twangy guitar, also with really great political lyrics and some great rappers involved. So, you know, he's been mixing genres and including electronic music with other genres for literally since we were in high school in the early 90s. So we gave him these tracks and we're like, hey, remix them. And he did these really great, cool remixes. And we liked that, the band liked them. And then the idea was like, can we do this for a whole album? Like, record, go into a studio, record a bunch of live music or record it the way we normally would. And then, cut and mix it. So that was the idea for the third album. Matt, I remember was the least into it and the most sort of like, this sounds dumb or like, just too much of a departure. And then, it was either after we did some first studio recording or just before, someone will comment and get this right. But at a certain point in the middle of making the third record, Moon went bankrupt.
Yeah, crazy timing for you guys. Yeah,
absolutely. But to everyone's credit, Bucket and Steven, everybody who was involved, like they, as part of how they dealt with the bankruptcy, and they didn't have to do it this way, they gave all the bands back their masters. So we got all our masters back for Before the Revolution, which allowed us to have a German label put it out on vinyl in Europe and things like that. And then they, gave us a bunch of merch, and also, and all of the backstock of the CDs, which is why I have a box full of them in my closet as we speak, which was all really cool and generous. And, you know, they could have done something else with that stock in order to limit their assets. I don't know. But it meant we like had a half an album recorded. But we, or maybe, yeah, maybe it was before we recorded anything, because as a result, no. Okay. Sorry. You might want to edit this, but now we did go into the studio when Moon was still around, because they were, before they went under, they had less money, right? I mean, it wasn't like an overnight thing. And so they were like, look, we've been spending too much on records, you know, paying for expensive production, et cetera. Can you bring the cost down? And so one of the ways that we brought the cost down was recording at Version City, which, you know, is a basement in Manhattan, where Vic Rice, Agent J, you know, basically like the Slackers scene, you know, plus like their, that whole entourage would sort of just like record their passion projects. And just, there's a bunch of great records recorded in that little studio. And so we went and recorded the basic tracks there. And then Oscar took them, and he had his own small studio, and yeah, we cut it up. We added in rappers, guest rappers. We did just a whole, we sent a tape to Germany to Dr. Ringding to have him do some lyrics on a track. And it turned out to be, I think, a really great record. It's very strange. I was listening to it the other day. It's really weird. I try to rap, which was like a huge mistake. Luckily, other people were better at it. But yeah, it was an innovative album. And so it was only released by Grover, by the German label that we had developed a relationship with through touring over there. So it's never been sort of mass released here in the US, though it's on our Spotify at this point, so people can listen to it. But if we had stayed together as a band, if things had gone differently and we had kind of gone further down the road that we started with that album, yeah, I think there could have been something really interesting that came out of it. Mm-hmm. And like a whole other subgenre of ska for us to complain about, of like trip hop ska. Well, you know, that whole trip hop ska thing that Justin did. But that got totally out of hand, and you know,
I want to kind of conclude by talking a little bit about your post-Adjusters career in politics, just because I think that kind of a way to tie it all together.
Yeah, and maybe I can fill in what I know about what the other band members are doing.
Are you currently the vice chair of the California Democratic Party, or you were recently?
I was, a couple of years ago, but I was defeated for re-election because I got in, well, several reasons, but the main thing being getting into a big open fight with the chair of the party, who is a, you know, sort of typically privileged and mediocre white man who's been handed a ton of political power. And I, you know, kind of said that a lot, and that he didn't like that. So so I'm no longer the vice chair. But I make a living doing political consulting and sort of organizing, advice and training for political parties and unions, mostly in Europe. My last big project has been in Stockholm, working with the Social Democrats there, and specifically in helping them do a better job of organizing and engagement with minority communities in Stockholm. And I've done some teaching because I got a doctorate in sociology after moving back to Santa Barbara. So I do some teaching on and off. You know, I try to stay away from the traditional political consulting that goes on in the US of like working for politicians on campaigns, because I hate politicians. I think they're a necessary evil, but like the worst thing about politics. And I prefer working with organizations, and whether that's like an issue-based organization or a union or a political party. But I like to help people build institutions that get regular people power. Mm-hmm. And that's like slow work and thankless work. And, you know, it's like hurting cats that are armed. It's like hurting, you know, there's hurting cats, but this is like the cats also have guns. That's what it feels like often in politics. And right now at the moment, I don't have any clients and I'm just home with my 15-week-old baby girl, Ada, which I'll be doing for a few more months. And then, yeah, who knows, looking for other projects to do.
Yeah. So if you're listening, if you run a political or if you run a an organization and you need a political consultant, see,
yeah,
you might get some work from this podcast right here.
Hey, that'd be rad. I like it. Babies are expensive, it turns out, which is weird because they're so small.
Do you want to? Yeah, you said so. We can conclude if you wanted to say what the other members are up to and call it an episode.
Yeah. So let's see. So, God, that's the thing about ska bands, right? It's like there were so many people that have been in the band. There's like 400 people that are ex-adjusters, but like with the kind of core folks, so Joan Axthelm, one of the other vocalists, lives in Colorado, is working. I think she is a teacher at some level, but seems to be doing very well. Jessica Basta is in LA, and as I said, married to Ben, a former bassist. She still is doing music and has a number of projects. The last one that I saw was a musical tribute related to Yoko Ono's birthday, and was very strange, but cool. I mean, Jess is a phenomenal musician and really into, yeah, just like interesting stuff. She was working with a performer, Zap Mama, for a long time. She continues to do stuff. Matt Parker, our organist, moved first to Britain and then now is in the Pacific Northwest in Washington State. And I know still plays music, you know, sort of pickup, sit-in fashion every once in a while, but continues to... he was just on a panel I saw at the Grammy Center down in LA, a recent panel discussion about the LA ska scene, which is cool. Jason Packer is still doing music. Our guitarist has a record he did, some kind of conceptual rock around something computer related that I don't understand. So I'm going to send you a link you could put in the show notes and people can check it out.
Yes.
It's some esoteric coolness. Who am I forgetting? Tom, one of our trombone player for a while, I know was in playing in Muka Pazza. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but that like punk rock marching band in Chicago. For a while, and I know I'm forgetting people and they're going to be really mad, but I'd say, you know, the person who's sort of like stuck with it, music on a really professional level is Oscar, at Gangsta Grass. But we all still talk and keep in touch. We make a tiny bit of money on royalties on, Spotify that we donate, every year to the Alpha Boys School in Jamaica.
Hell yeah. Nice.
Yeah, which is kind of, I guess that's my whole point, is like, that's my critique, is like, what are we giving back? Like, here is a music that comes from struggle and poverty and innovation and bravery in the face of colonialism, that's been picked up and spread by a black diaspora around the world. And so let's like think about that and be conscious of that as we're expanding the genre to include different types of music, which I'm for, but making sure that there's the meaning and the history and the heritage isn't totally lost. Got to give back.
Thank you for listening to In Defense of Ska. To support the show, sign up for our Patreon. Intro and outro music by Slow Gherkin from the EP Lives. Additional music by Dan P. and the Bricks. Please rate and review the podcast and tell a friend. Follow at In Defense of Ska on social media. The book In Defense of Ska by Aaron Carnes is available from Clash Books. Order it online. Chris Reeves of SPI is our editor. This is your co-host, Adam Davis of Omnigon, leaving you by saying ska now more than ever.
Do you speak any Japanese, Aaron?
I mean, arigato, I think arigato. That's probably it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about moshi moshi?
What's that mean?
That's what people will say when they answer their phones.
Okay.
There's mabudachi. You know mabudachi? What's that? Do you know what it is?
I don't know what that means.
It's best friend. Do you know what psycho is?
No.
Psycho means the best. And you know who's the best? You know who's totally psycho? Is
who?
Are the people who sign up for our Patreon.
Oh, they are the best.
They are the best. They support this podcast. They talk to us on the Discord, let us know what we're doing, what we could be doing better, what they like that we did. And for only $5 a month, folks, you can be part of that, and you can listen to the rest of this conversation behind the curtain.
And then you can hear what Adam and I really think of these people.
What we really think.
So sign up for the Patreon. If you don't sign up for the Patreon, we're going to start putting it at the beginning, just 5 minutes. Of
5 minutes of us just talking about the Patreon at the beginning. See, notice we didn't talk about it at all until like the podcast is over, unless you want more. It's over on the Patreon. But like,
yeah, see, we're so considerate.
We held off for the hard sell until the very, very, very last
I was thinking
minute.
About it the whole episode, though. I was just like, got to mention the Patreon, got to mention the Patreon.
Oh, I didn't think about it for 1 second. I was locked in.